Welcome to Kitchen Table Conversations, a series of short and shareable conversation starters for those of us who have or love and support people with a complicated and beautiful brain. Here's your host, Angela Geddes.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Kitchen Table Conversations. I'm your host, Angela, and thanks so much for tuning in today. Today, I want to talk a little bit around a conversation that happened around my kitchen table with a few friends and colleagues over the last little while. And we've been talking about what we've been seeing in our clinical practice and then also just within communities. So some of us are teachers, some of us are social workers, some of us are both. And some of us have very good friends and family members who are in the education system, and some of us see on a daily basis some of the trials and tribulations that individuals and family members experience trying to get the kinds of supports that they need in order to be really helpful and to be really successful. Moving forward. So we heard stories about people who had, you know, a ton of advocacy and a ton of ability within the family unit to support academic progress in the best ways possible, but yet still, because individuals weren't necessarily the squeaky wheel kind of thing, the school system didn't really recognize their educational needs as being high priority because they weren't really causing much difficulty, and the school day went by generally without a glitch. But unfortunately, by the time these individuals get to high school, they are significantly behind, which then impacts everything from view of self and the view of the world and their place within it, and their hope for the future. And then we've heard other stories about kids who were, in fact, or are, in fact, the squeaky wheel, who get tons of attention, but yet still not receiving the kinds of supports that are necessary in order for them to experience success. So we also have, you know, some of our most vulnerable children feeling even more vulnerable and identified as being the bad kid. And then we also have parents and caregivers that are coming in to see me on a regular basis who are really emotional, really distraught, really at wit's end, and really starting, you know, really beating themselves up for not being able to provide the parenting support and strategies and love and care and routine and structure that these children need in order to be successful. So I guess what I'm saying is that there's areas of challenge all across the board. We're seeing in our practices and certainly in our schools the need for more customized approaches. And, you know, I think it's important to note that just anecdotally from some of my teacher friends and family, the need for individual education plans has just skyrocketed over the last little while. And now there's a bit of a turn in some research saying that are these IEPs being as helpful as we think they are, or are they as helpful as we intend them to be? And I think the jury is still out. And I think that, again, some of our research is focusing on, you know, mental health concerns in and of themselves. And I think you guys know me enough to know that our research is not wholesome. It's not full. It's not absolutely reflective of what's really going on. And it can't be when you consider that 75% of people with FASD have been misdiagnosed with ADHD first. So, I mean, that's a pretty startling statistic. And then also the fact that the people who actually have been affected by prenatal alcohol exposure to the extent of which they should have an FASD diagnosis, given multiple, you know, research projects giving us a pretty, you know, pretty confident low estimate of 4% of our population qualifying for an FASD diagnosis, but knowing that less than 2% of those actually will ever have an assessment and be aware of their clinical diagnostic profile. So what we're seeing in, you know, in our school systems that require extra support and help are actually kids who have been exposed to alcohol and have had interference in their development, which means there's some brain damage and not just, and I don't want to minimize the extent that individuals struggle with mental health conditions, but there's a difference between anxiety, ADHD, depression, and FASD or brain damage that presents itself with a multitude of characteristics and other overlapping diagnoses. So there is a big difference, but how do we delineate that? And I would argue that our system is not capable at this point in time, given, again, those startling statistics that I'm sharing. So how do we, and I guess this is the question that I encourage everyone to bring back to their kitchen tables. I mean, how do we help people reach their potential when there's so much confusion out there? And, you know, if it was just anxiety and ADHD and people are asking for accommodations so to avoid group presentations, for example, well, I mean, how far do we go in order to make people comfortable? I mean, group therapy and group facilitation is a requirement for some people who are entering the field of social services. How can they do that if they require an accommodation that says you can't go up and public speak in front of anyone? So how do we do that? How do we engage in counseling sessions with family members if our anxiety is so high that we can't speak in front of other people with confidence? I mean, that's just a question that we have to ask ourselves, and then we have to determine whether or not that field of study is actually something that we're capable of doing. And I think that it's also really important that, you know, we all remind ourselves that it is not possible for every one of us to do anything that we want to do if we put our mind to it. I mean, that's a false narrative that I think we need to challenge. I think it is obviously really important to encourage people to follow their dreams or their interests or their strengths and really hone in on them and be the best that we can be no matter what it is that we decide to do. But not all of us are capable of being neuroscientists or physicians or lawyers or engineers or painters or construction people or car mechanics. Not everyone is capable of doing anything they want to do. I mean, I would love to be able to sing. Just, you know, that's just not for me. And it's probably better for the world that it's not. And that's okay. But how do we balance out giving people opportunity to test their skills, to hone in on them, to improve and to dream and to have hope that they can reach their potential, but then also provide people with the reality that, you know, there are some things that are out of reach. So I guess as per usual, I don't have any of the absolute answers. I mean, I have a few pretty good ideas, but that's up for another podcast. But I mean, it's complicated and it's really, really multifaceted and complex. But I think that we have to realize that, you know, individual education programming has increased incredibly, and yet the resources within the school system have not. How on earth can a teacher adequately address the needs of 30% of their classroom? And that's what it's amounting to these days. So, you know, we used to have one or two IEPs in a classroom. Now we're seeing 10 or 12. In post-secondary education too, again, these are anecdotal statistics here that I'm sharing with you, but it used to be 10% of your classroom would have students who required special accommodations, and now we're looking at closer to 30. And the irony here is that the accommodations often are given because people do struggle with anxiety or do struggle with executive functioning or planning and organizing and memory difficulties, but yet the accommodations are left to the individual student to advocate for themselves, which if they were able to advocate and remember and plan and organize and be able to look into the future and see what it is they need, they probably wouldn't need the accommodations. So there is an irony there that's not lost on me. And when I was a professor at Fanshawe College, it was, you know, it was difficult for me to say, well, I'm sorry, I can't give you these accommodations now, you're too late. When I know that one of the areas of challenge for this particular person is memory and planning and organizing. So, you know, again, I would try to make those extra accommodations, but yet if I did that for one student, I had to do it for all of them. And then if I did it as a professor, then that meant that the other professors had to do it too, which meant that I wasn't making friends within our team. So again, I don't have any answers for you, but I encourage us all to bring this back to our own kitchen table conversations for a couple of reasons. One of them is that I think it's important to note that what we see as maybe anxiety or mental health difficulties or bad behavior and poor parenting, oftentimes it's way more than that. And I believe with everything in me that kids will do as well as they are able to do in the moment. I believe parents will do as well as they can do with what they have available to them in the moment too, and that it is up to all of us to help raise our communities in a good, supportive way. I have seen evidence where this is not the case, and there is a lot of judgment, there is a lot of blame, there are a lot of accusations, and social media is terrible. I had an example just the other day where there's like parents in a Northern Ontario school where children were highlighted and, you know, their difficult behavior and maybe some meltdowns within the school were discussed openly on social media with some really harsh judgments made. And, you know, families and individuals have access to this social media platform as well, and they're mortified by what the community is saying about them and their children. And these children are really legitimately experiencing the impact of a complex neurodevelopmental disorder, and the family is just trying to figure it all out. You know, this is not easy. People have to work, people have to live, people have to sleep, and families are struggling. And yet we are so, so judgmental and so protective of our own kids. And I would encourage everyone to say, hey, if we could give a little bit of what we offer our kids when we're in a good place, if we can share that with some of the people who are struggling right now, you know, maybe we can try to do this balancing thing a little bit informally as well. I think we all need helpers from time to time. I've said that time and time again. We all do. And nobody raises a family in isolation, nor should they. And it does take a community to raise a child. So let's bring this conversation back home to our kitchen tables and see what we can do in terms of supporting one another. And then also having conversations around what's the difference between mental health conditions and complex neurodevelopmental disorders. And are we seeing a rise in ADHD and a rise in, you know, really complicated behaviors and difficulties within school systems? Yes, we absolutely are. And we are also seeing a rise in consumption of alcohol and other substances during pregnancy. And that cannot be ignored. So we do all have a responsibility to support healthy pregnancies as well. I also want to make it clear that I am well aware that alcohol and other prenatal substances are not the only reason why we're seeing complex neurodevelopmental conditions and a rise of some of the difficulties that we're seeing within the school system. So I think that's really important to note, but we cannot ignore that the statistics are startling, and alcohol and other substances do contribute greatly to, you know, what we're experiencing right now in terms of a mental health crisis and the extra difficulties that our young students and our older students are experiencing. So I please encourage you to have this conversation back at home. With many thanks, Angela.